Joe Bova was a man living the good life. He was married, with a good job, and a prominent position in his local union. He was well liked by everyone, including neighbors, co-workers, fellow union members, members of his church, and the community of Merrillville, Indiana, at large. One cool September morning, however, a large explosion would rock the streets of Merrillville, shattering the quiet peace of the pre-dawn hours. A neighbor would investigate the source of the explosion to find a burning vehicle, and outside of it would be Joe Bova. This is Midwest Mystery Files, Episode 34, The Murder of Joe Bova. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Midwest Mystery Files. I'm your host, Jeremiah, with just a few quick things before we start. Midwest Mystery Files is a true crime podcast focused on missing and murdered cases within the Midwestern region of the United States. I can be found on all major podcast platforms, as well as on YouTube with delayed episodes. Social media and contact info will be listed at the end of the episode. I'd also like to say, welcome back. If you're on social media, you may have seen that I chose to take an extended break from the podcast in order to try and sort some stuff out and be a bit more consistent. As of now, May and early summer is a busy time for me, so we'll still probably be looking at episodes every 3 weeks or so again, with hopefully moving to a bi-weekly release schedule at least some of the time. If you're back after all this time, I just want to say thank you for sticking it out and continuing to be a listener. If you wish to support the podcast and help fund article and record searches, as well as get early access to episodes and bonus episodes, I encourage you to check out my Patreon at www.patreon.com/MidwestMysteryFiles. I would also like to take this moment to thank my amazing patrons, Laura, Todd, and Teresa. They have definitely shown unlimited patience and understanding throughout this entire process. Now, without further ado, on to today's case. Joseph Anthony Bova was born August 23rd in Hammond, Louisiana, to Anthony and Rose Bova. He was one of five children, with two sisters and two brothers. I couldn't find much on Joe's early life, but I know that the family would eventually move to Gary, Indiana, and live in the Tolston and Brunswick sections of the city before settling permanently in Merrillville, Indiana, just 11 miles south of Gary. Joe would graduate from Merrillville High School in 1965, and in September of 1973, Joe would marry Sharon Boger, and the two would continue to reside in Merrillville for the duration of their marriage. In September of 1989, Joe was working as a part-time secretary treasurer for Local 81 of the Laborers International of North America, a union that represented workers in four northwest Indiana counties. At this juncture, he had worked more than 10 years as a laborer and union steward for Hunter Corp, a company that, according to articles from the time, provided maintenance work in Burns Harbor, Indiana. Prior to being elected as secretary treasurer for the union in 1988, he had served as an auditor for close to 12 years. Joe was described by those that knew him as being a religious union man with deep family roots, who liked his privacy and was there when you needed him. Many would speak of his dedication to his work. One colleague would tell the Post Tribune, quote, "He was non-controversial, quiet, interested in learning, not like some of the guys I cut my teeth with." He would continue on to state that at union conferences and seminars, Joe was always present, stating, quote, "He wasn't out on the golf course or in the gin mills." Joe was also a deeply religious man who was a member of the Merrillville Christian church and hosted Bible meetings in his home. One member of the church would note to the Post-Tribune, quote, "He was serious about religion. We sat around his table, and he led the Bible study." Joe was also said to have a strong love of animals. It's been stated that during the winter, Joe would go to the steel mill to feed stray cats who lived there. Everything was going good for Joe. Work was good with the union. Sharon was working as a cashier in a local supermarket, and they were living happily and comfortably in their ranch-style home in Merrillville. Unfortunately, all that would change one tragic morning. Wednesday, September 13th, 1989, was an average fall morning. Temperatures in the low 50s complemented the pre-dawn hours, where the Bovas were already active. Joe was preparing for work for the day, while Sharon drank her morning coffee. The last 2 days, Monday and Tuesday, Joe had ridden with his brother to work. However, today he would be driving himself to work after meeting his brother for breakfast. At 6 o'clock a.m., Joe told Sharon goodbye and headed outside toward his green 1974 Ford pickup truck. At approximately 6:04, an explosion rumbled through the neighborhood. John Depta, the Bova's neighbor, ran out his back door, thinking a gas main had exploded. He then heard moans coming from the front. Heading around to the front of his home, he would discover a tragic and horrifying sight. In the Bova's front yard, Joe's truck was a twisted cacophony of burning metal. 50 feet away, John would find Joe Bova, who had been thrown from his vehicle, laying face down. John would tell the Post-Tribune that Joe was still alive when he got to him, but was glassy-eyed, with several injuries, and unable to speak. When an ambulance and paramedics arrived on the scene, Joe was still breathing and had a pulse. But, unfortunately, he would be declared dead on arrival once the ambulance reached Methodist Hospital in Merrillville at 6:40 a.m. An autopsy would later find Joe's cause of death to be blood loss and severe trauma. Almost immediately, members of local law enforcement, as well as members of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or ATF, were on the scene at the Bova residence. Agents with the ATF searched the area, including the surrounding yards, with electrical equipment looking for any sort of bomb fragments or explosives. ATF Special Agent Jerry Singer would tell the press that an explosive device, approximately 2 inches in width and 8 inches in length, was identified as the device responsible for the explosion. Initial reports say the bomb was located in a generalized area outside the vehicle and near the front, but it would later be determined it was located underneath the front axle and wired to the ignition. Agent Singer did note that the explosive device may have some sort of signature and that it would be sent to the ATF laboratory in Rockville, Maryland, for further examination. If a signature was found, no word has ever been reported on it. It was also noted that it was impossible to determine an exact time that the bomb could have been placed, other than between 7 o'clock p.m. on September 10th, when Joe last drove the vehicle, and 6 o'clock a.m. September 13th, when Joe left the house to head to his vehicle. Immediate questions were raised about who could commit such a heinous act, especially against someone as well-liked as Joe Bova. Investigators would immediately turn their attention toward the local 81. This was a point in U.S. history where the now-defunct President's Commission on Organized Crime was actively investigating ties between certain organized crime groups and labor unions. Joe Bova's International Union was one of 4 unions that had been cited 3 years earlier as having ties to organized crime. However, the Local 81 and the Local 41, based in Northwest Indiana, were noted by local and federal authorities with having no connections, with Kenneth J. Lowry's, the assistant attorney in charge of the Chicago Organized Crime Strike Force, telling the Post-Tribune, quote, "If there are any public complaints about the laborers' union in Northwest Indiana, I don't know about them." In terms of the Local 81, Vehicles of Union officials were checked to ensure that there were no more explosive devices. They also began interviews almost immediately, starting with officials to narrow down any possible suspects. With Merrillville Chief of Police Jerry McGorry telling the Post Tribune in September 14, 1989, quote, "We've got some leads. They answered all questions freely. They told us who they viewed to be troublemakers in the union." He would continue to stress that this was not a sign of them believing it was union-related, stating, quote, "That's just where we started. It's a logical place to start. We'll be out in the neighborhood tonight, talking to all neighbors." It would be noted that Joe was one of a slate of candidates who ousted a 12-year incumbent from the top post of business manager the previous year, but it was determined early on there was no connection. As far as everyone in the union, they proved to be very helpful. In the first day of the investigation, many members were questioned, and no one seemed to have anything bad to say about Joe or anything going on within his circles. Things were also noted to be going well with the business and work environment in general. Merrillville Police Chief Jerry McCory would tell the Post Tribune, quote, "Everything we found out says it was running pretty good, pretty solid, with no problems like that. The people from the union we've talked to have been extremely cooperative and very open. Anything we need to look at, they're providing us." One other individual would note about Joe and the union as saying, quote, "I saw him recently and asked how things were going. He said, everything is going great. If you know anyone down on their luck, send them in and we'll put them to work." On September 15th, it was announced that Joe Bova's union was offering $30,000 for information leading to an arrest for those responsible for Joe's murder. Four detectives would be assigned to Joe's case, as well as agents with the ATF. A September 16th article from the Chicago Sun-Times would note that investigators did speak with three men who had disagreements with Joe. The disagreements would turn out to be quite minor, though, and the three men were quickly ruled out as suspects. In a September 21st article from the Post Tribune, it would be stated that several members of the union were asked to take polygraph tests. It was never stated who the members were or why the tests were prompted, but Police Chief McCory would tell the Tribune, quote, "This doesn't mean any past or present union officers are suspects in the death. We're not ready to say we have a suspect." He would note that all individuals agreed to do the tests and would state, quote, "Right now, we are going through the process of elimination, and the polygraph may assist us in doing that." The weeks would begin to move on. Union members would continue to be interviewed. Union records would be checked, which was standard procedure after a violent death involving union officials. But little would come in the way of leads, even with the $30,000 waiting to be rewarded. Police Chief McCory would tell the Post Tribune on October 20th, 1989, quote, "We never had any calls for the reward money, but we hear that may not be as unusual in a bombing as in other cases. We have nothing to point to any individual or group." Despite this, McCory would state, quote, "We still have a lot of people to talk to." Time would continue to move. The Indiana fall would give in to winter, and soon to spring and summer, with little headway made or leads found in Joe's case. In June of 1990, Joe's widow, Sharon Bova, and other family members would reward a $1,000 scholarship in Joe's memory to one of the children of the local 81's members. At this time, the Post Tribune would speak to Sharon Bova, who would say of her husband, quote, "I have to know who and why they did it. I pray they find out. I've got to have those two answers. They're driving me insane. Joe is such a good person. I can't imagine who would want to hurt him. None of it makes any sense." Frank Bova, Joe's brother, would prove optimistic at the time. Despite frustration at the lack of progress, he would tell the Tribune, quote, "I know they're working as hard as they can. I call them every week. I think they'll find who did it. It may take some time, but I think they'll find him. Merrillville Police Chief McCory, on the other hand, would express a bit more doubt, stating, quote, "It is a case that is clearly going to take a break. It's not something that legwork is going to solve. Someone is going to have to say something to someone. You don't get breaks like that all the time." McCory would unfortunately express the same sentiment on the one-year anniversary of Joe's fiery death, telling the Times in Munster, Indiana, on September 13th, 1990, quote, "We really just don't have much to go on. We are just hoping, praying, for a break. It's possible that the only person who knows the identity of the killer is the killer himself." To add to this, ATF Special Agent Jerry Singer would tell the Times, quote, "It's still open, and we're still following up leads. But right now, we don't have anything that would lead to an arrest. Sometimes these kind of cases take months, and sometimes it's years. That's because these cases follow their own patterns." As the years would continue to roll on, reports on the anniversary of Joe's death would ultimately and unfortunately sound the same, with no new leads, even with the local running ads every year to remind people of the $30,000 in reward money. Something else that would persist through the years, though, would be the insistence and remembrance of Joe's good nature, and his willingness to help anybody out. Unfortunately, some rumors would persist as well, with Sharon Bova telling the Post Tribune in 1993, quote, "People say, well, he must have done something to get murdered." She would cite that Joe was involved in drugs or was crooked in union business as just two of the rumors she had heard. She would go on to say, quote, "My husband was one of the most upright, honest men there was. He was not a saint. None of us are. But he was my whole life." Unfortunately, Sharon would never receive answers as to who took her husband from her and why. She would survive 20 years, but would pass away in 2009 at the age of 65, still extremely heartbroken, as she had understandably never healed from the loss of her husband. Sharon's sister would tell the Times, quote, "They might as well have put a gun to her head and killed her too. She couldn't get past it. She tried. I guess she tried the best she knew how." At that time, Kim Riddle, agent and spokesperson for the ATF, would tell the Times that the case was unsolved, but they were still welcoming new tips. She would state, quote, "As we say, they have run cold. As for the current state of Joe's case, that appears to be where it still sits. The latest article I could find, posted by the Times Herald, would state that the ATF's Merrillville office was still working in conjunction with local police, but no new information had come in quite some time. Although Brett Parlock, a nephew of Joe's, who was 9 at the time of his death, has continued to probe the case and speak with investigators regularly. Parlock would tell the Herald Times, quote, "I was very fond of him. I remember him being good to me." A sentiment about Joe that continues to linger throughout the years from everyone who speaks about him. It's been just shy of 35 years since Joe Bova walked out of his home, entered his vehicle, and died a horrific, fiery death. From day one, everyone was baffled. No one had a bad thing to say about Joe, and no one could think of a reason that someone may want to hurt him. It was due to this, and the extremely anonymous nature of a bombing, that it was next to impossible to track down likely suspects or generate any leads. In the absence of any real answers, we're really only left with theories. Two schools of thought are really all that have ever come to mind. One being that the bombing was personal and union-related, or that it was a completely random act, and Joe was the unfortunate victim of that random act. As far as the union goes and the death being related, I don't really want to go down the rabbit hole of pro versus anti-union conjecture in the social and cultural zeitgeist, because that's not what this podcast is about. But with some groups, unions have always been related to or associated with corruption, which is why it's easy to see why some people may be convinced that this is where the answers lie. It is also just a logical place to look, seeing as how Joe had been connected for many years, and his connections most likely ran deep. However, as stated before, everyone talked to was extremely cooperative and helpful, and while the larger international union that the Local 81 belonged to had been cited in the past as having connections to organized crime, the Local 81 had had zero issues or citations. And this does come at a time in American history where those connections were being strongly looked at across the board, with a lot of prejudice. So I'm inclined to believe if there was something, investigators would have found it, and it may not have been so easily swept under the rug, as easily as some people may think. That's not to say someone connected to Joe couldn't have done it. Some of the deadliest killers in history have had supreme poker faces when being questioned. So it's possible someone was overlooked, or was possibly being looked at, but it was kept quiet by law enforcement. My own personal thought on this is, if it was personal, why a bomb? If it had to do with some sort of corruption, which I don't personally think is the case, a car bombing makes sense as a message. However, it does seem a bit overproduced for some sort of a vendetta killing, especially if you don't want the attention this would have garnered. Then again, people have done the same thing for far more petty reasons in the past. As far as a random occurrence goes, some may find this unlikely. However, I want to list a few other pipe bomb incidents out in Indiana alone during this time. In April of 1987, a 27-year-old Valparaiso man died in the midst of constructing a homemade pipe bomb. On April 17, 1989, 19-year-old David Swinford placed a pipe bomb in a toothpaste package at an Indianapolis Kmart store, which took part of a 5-year-old girl's hand. He took his own life 2 days later. 10 days later, explosives were found in the car of an Indianapolis man who had suffered a fatal heart attack. His intentions were unknown. In February 1990, 21-year-old Michael Bader of Crown Point was charged for bombing a home in rural Indiana. His case, specifically, is noted in articles as being ruled out in connection with Joe's case. In 1992, a group of men were charged for setting off pipe bombs in Hammond and Highland to distract from robberies. These bombings also resulted in deaths. According to FBI statistics, there were 2,300 reported pipe bombs in the Midwest between 1977 and 1986, both targeted and non-targeted attacks. Looking at this information alone, it doesn't really answer the question as to if Joe's murder was targeted or he was chosen at random. But it certainly makes him being chosen at random as being even more haunting and tragic if that was the case. Joe Bova was a well-loved, well-respected, church-going, family, and union man. He worked hard and was sure to give anyone who came to him a fair shake and a fair opportunity at a job. He even fed hungry animals in the winter. Everyone loved him, and he was seen as honest by all those who knew him. He was also a loving husband, uncle, brother, and son. All this, though, was either unknown or not cared about to the person or persons that decided it was okay to take an innocent man's life in a horrific fashion. Whether targeted or random, the malice behind such a crime shows such a regard for his life and all those around him. And in the wake of his murder, among other family members, Sharon Bova was left heartbroken and alone, with her husband being taken from her in an instant. After 35 years, an outlook may not look great in a case like this, but as always, that's where you and I come in. I encourage you to either share this episode or any resources you may choose to look at yourself. Even now, we may never know who might remember something and may not even realize it. All they might need is the right reminder to push them. If you have any information on the murder of Joseph Bova, please contact the local ATF office at 219-755-6310 or the Merrillville, Indiana Police Department at 219-769-3722. If you're looking for additional information on the case, the Post Tribune and the Times have the most useful information. I will also post a link in the show notes of article screenshots compiled by Reddit user The Bones of Autumn that they used for their own Reddit write-up on the case, which will also be linked. If you wish to let me know what you think happened, have case suggestions or comments, or just want to follow me and the show on social media, I can be found on Instagram at Midwest Mystery Files, X at Files Midwest, and on Facebook by searching for Midwest Mystery Files. You can also email me at MidwestMysteryFilesPod@gmail.com. I do also post photos and sometimes links relevant to each case on social media, mainly on Facebook and Instagram. Lastly, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Good Pods, please feel free to rate and review the show. This helps make the show more visible in searches, and more importantly, helps bring attention to the cases I cover. Thank you to all who have done so already. Take care, everyone, and I will see you all next time.